Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1270, we present two stories by new Life Rattle writer, Belinda Gramado Grayburn. Belinda Gramado Grayburn, who we introduced last week, is a first-generation Canadian. Born in 1973 in Windsor, Ontario, Belinda is the youngest of two daughters. Her parents, originally from Sicily, Italy, immigrated from France in the mid-1960s. Her father was a carpenter and her mother sewed for one of the big three automakers. Both parents influenced Belinda greatly and taught her the importance of hard work, ingenuity, and persevering through adversity. Belinda lived in Windsor for 19 years before moving to the Greater Toronto Area to study American Sign Language. She is married and has a teenage boy who is the center of her world. After living many years in both Toronto and Mississauga, Belinda and her family have settled down in what she describes as the small but lovely town of Carlisle, Ontario. Belinda Gramado Grayburn currently works at a university and continues her studies in creative writing while also training for her first triathlon. Belinda makes good writing look effortless. Belinda's stories and her reading of her stories have a rare natural fluidity that presents quite a contrast to the earnest nature of the emotionally engaged narrator. Last week, we heard three lighthearted pieces from Belinda. The two stories we will hear tonight take us toward the opposite end of the spectrum. In tonight's first story, our narrator asks her mother to share a story from her childhood in Sicily. She responds with a lyrical tale of traveling through the mountains at night with her father, who was forced to sell food on the black market to keep his family fed during the Second World War. Her mother's telling brings an aura of magic to the story, which almost has us forgetting the dire circumstances. Let's listen now as Belinda Gramado Grayburn reads Sing, Anna, Sing, tonight on Life Rattle.
Sing, Anna, Sing by Belinda Gramado Grayburn. This interview takes place over coffee at the kitchen table in my mother's home in Windsor, Ontario. My 73-year-old mother, a resident of Canada since the mid-1960s, was born and raised in Sicily, Italy. I ask her to tell me stories from when she was a young girl. "Let me tell you the story about the drunken pig," my mom says, getting up to bring me a homemade Sicilian cookie. "That one's funny." "Yeah, but I don't get a chance to see you in that story, Mom. I want to hear about when you were little in Italy." "What was it like growing up there?" I ask. "Sometimes when you tell things about your family, honey, people don't understand. It was a different time, a different culture." I give my mom a look to signify that I won't let her off that easily. Reluctantly, she takes a seat. She stirs her coffee, places the teaspoon on her napkin, and passes me the sugar. "I was born in 1938, so I was still young during World War II. I lived with my parents, my sister Pina, and my younger sister Franca, who was severely disabled. At that time, whatever you produced, whether you had a farm or other type of industry, you had to relinquish it to the government, and in exchange, they would give you food stamps. The instituted rations were meager, and if you had five people in your family, you had just enough bread for five people. No more, no less. You couldn't celebrate a religious holiday with a special meal because there was nothing extra. You had absolutely no money for anything. As the war progressed, it became increasingly difficult for people to feed their families and survive. A black market began. Instead of handing everything over to the government, people would save a little here and hide a little there, and either sell it themselves or give it to someone to sell for them on the black market. My father, a risk-taker, bought from these people. In addition to what he held back on his own farm, he purchased beets, fava beans, wheat, and other foods, and he would travel to the other cities to sell them. These cities were on the other side of the mountain. To travel, my father either voyaged through the mountains or through seaside passages. We didn't have cars back then, only the traditional carretto, a colorful Sicilian-style carriage hooked to a mule. Why did he travel to other cities, I ask? Couldn't he sell them in Alcamo? Not every city grew the same type of crops. By selling in another city, my father could purchase things we didn't have. Traveling by mule and cart took several hours and was risky. By day, you took a chance with the police. If they stopped you, they could take everything you have. It happened to my father once. A blockade had been set up, and the police were about to push back the hay in the cart and find the hidden goods. My father approached the police officer and said, "I have family. Do you have family?" The police officer nodded. "Okay," my father said. "Tomorrow, come and find me at this address. I'll make sure your family gets fed." The next day, the police officer showed up, and my father gave him everything he could. After that, he traveled by night. To make it to the next city for the morning, he had to leave by 3 a.m. The route through the mountains could be dangerous. The path was dark. Only two oil lanterns hung on either side of the carriage. The cities below had their lights extinguished for fear of air raids. But my father had other worries besides the war and the dark. Ladri. How do you say it? Thieves, I say. Yes, thieves. Once, coming home from working on the farm, it rained and he placed his bread in the satchels of the mule's saddle. During the walk home, a thief snuck up on the other side of the mule, slit the satchel, and removed the bread without him knowing it. My father arrived home empty-handed. In the mountains, they were not so gentili, nice. We heard stories of thieves taking everything from travelers, including the mule and cart, leaving the victim on foot and alone in the mountains. They robbed because they had no food, no clothes, no home, nothing. They were desperate but not evil. They had a code of honor, too. If they heard a family passing through, they would not cause trouble. They had no intention of scaring children. They often thought it to be peasants traveling from city to city to farm and let them pass safely. In the summertime, when school was over, I would beg my father to take me with him. Sometimes he would say no, but other times he would let me come along. I loved it. Were you ever scared? For me, it was like a vacation. I saw the mountains and the sea, and when we reached the city, we stayed with friends and I explored the villages. How was traveling through the mountains? I slept for most of the way. My father loaded the cart with beans and wheat and put hay on top for me to sleep on. From time to time, he woke me up and said in Sicilian, "Sing, Anna, sing. Keep me company." I sang all the time at home and in church, so this was a pleasure for me. I had a high, beautiful voice, and I sang love songs in the darkness. You could hear my voice echo across the valleys. We were always safe. No one bothered us. We reached the city by morning and sold all of our goods over 2 or 3 days. My father always made a point of buying a little gift for my mother before we returned. He adored her. I smile at my mom. It was my choice to go. I loved being with my father, and I loved traveling. She gets up to stir the pasta sauce cooking on the stove. "Let me tell you the story about the drunken pig," she says. "Now that's a funny story."
That was Sing, Anna, Sing, written and read by Belinda Cremato Grayburn. Tonight's second story is a breathtakingly exquisite recounting of the death of a close friend. Belinda brings an extraordinarily deft touch to her observations in this unique and devastating presentation of the winding down of a human life. Let's listen now as Belinda Gramado Grayburn reads her story, Letting Go.
Letting Go by Belinda Gramado Grayburn. 90 pounds. I follow Annie to the window seat in her kitchen and notice that her tights look baggy. You know, people complain about taking weight off. I can't seem to keep it on, she says, only half joking. I like your new wig, though, I say. Thanks, she replies with a big grin. She adjusts her black Cleopatra-style hairdo, and we sit in our regular spot by the window, and I pour the tea. What's that? I ask, pointing to a book on a nearby table. Just some photos I've been going through, she says. May I? Of course. I flip through old photos. Oh my gosh, Annie, is this you? Look at you in those days. How old were you then? 19. Wow, gorgeous picture. Is that Mark? I tilt my head back and laugh. Nice brown polyester pants. I turn the page. Oh, your wedding photos. They're lovely. Yes, Mark chased me for a long time, she says. Really? You didn't want to get married? I say. Are you kidding? I was having too much fun. Mark was so serious and jealous, and I was the complete opposite, a free spirit. He finally wore me down, though, and I got him to lighten up, she chuckles. How's he doing now? I ask. Good. He comes to every appointment with me, works from home when he can, and takes on more of the household chores. Once my chemo's done, we plan to go to Cuba. 81 pounds. I walk to the backyard deck and find Annie, sitting in a chair and wrapped in a blanket, staring at the ground in front of her. Hi, I say, and take a seat beside her. How do you feel? Toxic. Mark opens the back door and joins us on the deck. Annie tolerated the first few rounds of chemo well, he says, but this one hit her hard. We just need to make sure she stays hydrated. Let me make some tea, I offer, and head back into the house. Waiting for the water to boil, I notice the framed photos on the walls. Vacations with their two boys, celebrations with family and friends, and memorable times with international students who stayed in their home over the years. 76 pounds. Annie and I sit together at the window seat in the kitchen. The radiation treatments to her neck make it hard for her to speak. He did it again, she says coldly. Did what? He cheated, and with the same woman. Annie pounds her fist against her bony leg. Why would he do this to me now? How could I be such an idiot? I feel like a fool, like it was happening all along and I was just too stupid to notice. Are you sure he cheated? I ask. She nods. I found emails. She takes off her glasses and wipes her dripping nose. Why couldn't he just wait until I was gone? A year ago, Annie had told me about Mark's first indiscretion. I was diagnosed in 94, and 3 years later, when I was in remission, he had an affair with a woman from work. I found out and kicked him out for 9 months. What about the boys? I inquired. I raised John and Eddie on my own and didn't tell anyone we separated. We showed up at functions together, and then he went to his apartment, and I went home at the end of the night. Did you want him back? I wasn't sure. This didn't happen to couples like us, or at least that's what I thought. In recovery, I talked with support groups and read articles only to find out that this was common. What do you mean? Mark spent so much time caring for me and worrying about death that once I was well, he looked for someone who was willing to take care of him, if only for a brief moment. So, after 9 months of separation, I took him back. "That's a hard one to forgive," I said. "Sometimes, Belinda, good men do bad things." 63 pounds. Annie can no longer speak. Mark bought a magna doodle for her to write on. This time she does not kick him out. "How is it today?" I ask. Annie writes on the toy. "Life is beautiful. Death is peaceful. Dying is hard." 58 pounds. Annie can no longer walk. Mark carries her from room to room and does his best to make her feel comfortable. Her lungs are filling with fluid and she can barely swallow. She's slowly suffocating and starving to death, Mark explains in a quiet but steady voice. "People will be here soon." Annie's sister Sandra calls from upstairs. "Belinda, would you help me give Annie a sponge bath?" "Sure, I'll be right there." I pat Mark's arm and walk upstairs. To keep Annie warm, we uncover only small parts of her body at any given time. A foot, a leg, an arm. "So thin. I've never seen anyone so thin," I think to myself. "Okay, Annie, we need to roll you over now," Sandra says. Annie nods and braces for us to move her. We turn her slowly until she lies on her belly. Three large lumps on her back stare up at us. Sandra and I freeze and look at each other. With chin and hands trembling, Sandra carefully cleans around her sister's tumors. 54 pounds. Annie wants to remain at home, Mark informs the visitors who crowd the main floor of their house. I look at the line of people waiting to say goodbye. I walk past and recognize many of them. I nod at Annie's co-workers, Christine and George. I say hello to her neighbors, Mr. Murphy and his wife. I hug Annie's sister-in-law, Catherine, and her kids. I shake hands with Annie's old and dear friend, Susan, and wave to John and Mary, who Annie met in line at the grocery store only a few years ago. Annie's two boys, John and Eddie, sit with their grandparents in the family room. I wait until later that evening to see Annie. I enter her bedroom and find the hospice nurse swabbing morphine onto Annie's gums. I lie down on the bed beside Annie and wait for her to recognize me. Her eyes, dark and distant, eventually find my face. "Hi," I say. I smile and cry at the same time. She manages a smile and squeezes my hand as best she can. She opens her mouth to say something. I put my ear to her mouth to hear. "Mark," she breathes softly. "Okay, I'll get him." Mark stays in the bedroom with Annie for the rest of the night. He reads her Robert Frost poems, and he's by her side when she dies. 1 year later, Mark marries the other woman.
That was Letting Go, written and read by Belinda Grimaldo Grayburn. That concludes Life Rattle number 1270. My name is Lori Callis. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune in next week to hear stories from new Life Rattle writer, Reed Dalmazar.